So welcome to the beginning of the five-week introductory course that we teach here about three times a year. And since people are still coming in, I'll start with probably the least essential part of the class and tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Gilf Bronsdal, and I've been teaching this practice, teaching Vipassana and Buddhist practices here in Palo Alto for 10 years. And I've been a practitioner for some 25 years, and did many years of Zen practice first, was ordained as a Zen priest. And then I went to Southeast Asia and practiced there intensely in the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism of Burma and Thailand, where I was taught this Vipassana practice. And I came back to this country and continued this particular practice here. And then in 1989, I was invited to be trained as a Vipassana teacher, as a Buddhist meditation teacher, by Jack Kornfield. And did a four-year training with him to do that. And 1990, at the same time, I moved down here so I could go to do doctoral studies at Stanford University, studying, of all things, Buddhist studies. So I had most of my adult life, I've been very actively immersed in the world of Buddhist practice, Buddhist studies, and it's a privilege for me to be here to introduce you to this particular practice, Vipassana practice, insight practice, which is considered to be the cream of Buddhism, the cream of Buddhist practice. In fact, in Southeast Asia, sometimes people are not taught this practice coming off the street casually, like many of you are, but rather you do all kinds of things in preparation for being able to receive these kinds of teachings. In particular, you spend some time preparing your ethical foundation, because if you're not really living an ethically sound life, it said this teaching won't go very far for you. You can't really use it very well. And then also you might spend some time doing practices which help stabilize or calm the mind so that the insight practice can be much more effective. But here in America, we do things upside down. Americans want the best fast. So we give you the insight practice. It's a very powerful practice, the practice of insight meditation. The Buddhist word for it is vipassana, so you might hear that word being spoken in various places. Vipassana means, the passana means to see. And the V means, it's a prefix which emphasizes. So some people translate it as special seeing or seeing clearly. That's all it means, so seeing clearly. In English, sometimes we call it mindfulness, and sometimes it's called insight practice. It's a very simple practice. There's nothing, even though it's considered the cream of Buddhist practice, there's nothing which inherently makes it Buddhist. And the way that I'll be teaching it to you these 5 weeks, the Buddhist part is, I'll mention some things perhaps that are more Buddhist, but that's quite optional. The practice doesn't require its Buddhist context. It's taking a function of the mind that all of us have. The Buddhists would say a function of the heart, but here in the West, we would use the word mind for that. It's a function of the mind to simply know what's going on in the present moment. It's the ability to pay attention, to be aware. What we're doing in this practice is cultivating and developing that so it becomes a regular, stable part of our lives than it normally is. As we do that, as it becomes a more regular and stable part of our lives, it tends to bring a lot of benefit to our lives. And many people have adopted mindfulness meditation, mindfulness practice here in America in the last 10, 20 years for many of its beneficial uses. One of the very popular places is in pain and stress management clinics. All over the country, there are hospitals in place. Maybe some of you here have gone through Mark Abramson's stress reduction class at Stanford. And it's proven to be highly effective for pain management, for stress reduction. And people have then taken it out of its Buddhist context and offered in that setting. It helps with personal insight. Many psychologists, or therapists have recommended insight meditation to their clients because it helps with the process of self-reflection, self-understanding. And it, more important, perhaps, is it helps with the process of self-acceptance. And how that works, maybe will be explained later on. So it's proven to be very helpful with people in therapy. I don't know if this is the right place to mention this, but I've talked to a number of therapists who have worked with clients who both have a meditative background, like doing a lot of mindfulness practice, and ones that have not done any meditation or Buddhist practice. And they say there aren't necessarily so obvious differences in terms of the psychological difficulties they're struggling with. But the big difference is the people who have done a lot of Buddhist practice are much less defensive about talking about how they're feeling. They're less protected. They're much more willing to be exposed, much more self-accepting in that way, to talk about what's going on. So the practice helps for stress, it helps for pain management, it helps for psychological insight, it helps for psychological self-acceptance. In its Buddhist context, which might interest some of you, but maybe many of you it doesn't interest particularly, the insight practice is the Buddhist practice that leads to the liberation or the enlightenment that most of Buddhism, or all of Buddhism, kind of ultimately focuses on. The enlightenment of the Buddha, the full realization of our spiritual potential, is said to be in Buddhism to occur through this particular practice. And it's a practice which in some sense can seem very mundane, very matter-of-fact, kind of it's just learning to pay attention. But how is it that this practice of paying attention, taking a natural functioning of your mind and building it to a high pitch, can lead to enlightenment? Is one of the great, mysteries, but certainly one of the great miracles or great wonders of the world. I think that our culture has a tremendous need for contemplative practice. It needs to have some connection with practices that have reached deeper into the soul or deeper into the heart than simply its pain management help or its stress reduction help or just helping us cope a little bit better in our stressful life, but actually helps us to connect with some deeper contemplative truth, some deeper contemplative feeling of spiritual sense of being spiritual beings, being connected to a world which is not just a world of commerce and consumption, but a world which maybe we can understand to be sacred. I think that in its Buddhist context, the mindfulness practice is offered as a contemplative practice, offering all that is most sacred, at least for Buddhists. I think that for Buddhists, what's most sacred is not found externally, but is found in the arena of our own awareness, and in that all human beings are aware to some degree. It is, you know, that sacredness is available to all of us. I just finished teaching a week-long retreat at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Marin County. And as I was telling some people just now, the first or second day of the retreat, we got a phone call from a man who really wanted to get into the retreat. And it happened we had a cancellation, but there were 96 people already there, and it was a lot of work for the teachers. And here was someone who said he had never meditated before, wanted to come to an intensive meditation retreat. So we said, no, doesn't make sense. And he really wanted to come. And then he started telling us his story. And the manager who was taking the message kind of had a soft heart and said, we should really let this guy in. And so I said, well, okay, let him come and talk to me. And, you know, if he passes the Gill test, I'll put on my Zen persona and, you know, and be kind of tough. And so he explained, he came in and explained that he had a very difficult life. He was recently divorced and separated from his children and trying to make a living and support both his children and his wife and himself. And And he had very little time for himself now, very little vacation time for anything. But he had a little bit of time now over the New Year's to kind of get away, vacation, and he needed something. So he got in his motorcycle, and he went driving to go all over the state. And after a day or two on his motorcycle, he realized that what he was looking for was not outside of himself. He couldn't find it by driving his motorcycle some beautiful place or all over. And he had to go inside. And so then somehow he found out about Spirit Rock, this retreat. And he called, so he said, I have to go inside. I have to find out what's going on inside. I have to be with myself. And I have to find some way to cope with this mind of mine, which seems to be out of control. And this is my only chance, because otherwise I have to go back to work and, you know, a busy life and all that. And so what was I going to say? So I let him in, and it was really remarkable how he entered into retreat, I think on the second day of the retreat, when there's already a very powerful contemplative silence. Imagine 96 people sitting in intent, concentrated stillness for two full days. And he entered this sphere of contemplative practice and sat down, and to our amazement, he sat still for 5 days. To our amazement, it was one of the most important and transformative things that's happened in his life. And it seemed to change him radically. And we'll see, I don't know in the long term what happened, but you know, he just dropped into this. You know, he represented, for me at least, this tremendous calling or need our stressful society has for something like contemplative practice. And through luck and a lot of suffering and certain level of passion, he found himself in an intensive mode of it. So, in its essence, mindfulness practice is very simple. I can tell it to you in one sentence and you can go home. And the sentence is to leave all things alone while letting your awareness leave all things alone while you are carefully mindful of what it is you're leaving alone. To allow all things to be as they are while you're being attentive to how things are. So those two things. It isn't just simply bringing attention to things, but it's bringing a certain kind of attention that allows things to be as they are, to leave them alone. The immediate challenge to that, people say, well, is, you know, that seems like a rather passive spiritual practice. And what happens when the child runs out in the street in front of the car? You're supposed to kind of just practice allowing all things to be and to be attentively present. No way. But rather, this is a practice of what we do with a heart or with the mind or with awareness. The awareness does not cringe or tighten or reject or grasp. What we do with our body, what we do with our common sense, is what it is. But the awareness doesn't have to shut down. The awareness doesn't have to exclude or deny. And we know, I think a lot of us in the West, the tremendous ability the mind has of denial, of bias, of rejection, of turning away. The mind is a powerful, powerful instrument of being very selective about what it wants to pay attention to. What we're training here is for the mind no longer to have that kind of bias selection or bias denial or avoidance, but rather the mind is open to all things while being attentive to it. So to say it even more simply, it's simply paying attention to what happens in the present moment as it's happening. One of the remarkable things that people will discover as they begin paying more careful attention to their lives is how much of the time we're not present. How much of the time we're thinking about the future and planning for whatever's going to happen, or planning for all the things that will never happen, or how much we rehearse and review the past, or how much we live in fantasy. And it's actually fairly hard for the untrained person to spend much time out of choice in the present moment, fully awake and present for what's going on right now. It might happen occasionally. You might go for a walk in nature. You might have a wonderful nap in the afternoon, or some wonderful thing might happen, and you find yourself kind of very present and unstressed, and the mind is quiet, and things seem quite wonderful. But it's kind of like an accident, or certain conditions help that happen. You go to waterworks and you get a wonderful massage. You know, but to just be able to stay in the present moment out of choice, in all kinds of circumstances, no matter how challenging the circumstances are, takes practice, takes a certain training. And that ability to be present in the present moment is best seen as kind of like a muscle that you can strengthen. All of us have this muscle of presence, so this muscle of awareness. So some people it's completely almost atrophied. For some people it's kind of flabby. And for some people, it's kind of underdeveloped. And it can be developed and strengthened like that muscle by training it, by repeated coming back, repeated using the muscle of attention, it becomes stronger and stronger. The less we get lost in fantasy world, the less we get involved in future and the past, and develop our capacity to pay attention, the stronger that ability becomes. So that ability is nothing particularly Buddhist about it, as I keep saying, and it's something you all have. Now, one of the first realizations is how little of the time we're in the present moment, and how out of control often the mind is. It's phenomenally humbling to try to sit down, close your eyes, and to try to keep the mind steady on the breath, which is one of the things we do. You try to stay with the breath, and the mind wanders off. It wanders off. He doesn't want to stay there. You're the most competent person that you know. You're able to multitask and get a lot of things done. You're very efficient. You're brilliant. You have great insight into all kinds of wonderful things, and you think you're pretty hot. And all you're asked to do is sit down and close your eyes and watch your breath. And it's impossible. You'd rather, follow the stock market. It's easier than following your breath. So it's very humbling. So you should realize that it's humbling for everyone who does this. That way, when you're humbled a little bit, you'll take it as a good sign. You'll take it as part of the contemplative movement that's supposed to happen. That you're supposed to be a little bit appreciative of the tremendous power of the mind, and then maybe you have less control over it than you realized. But then with time, because it's a training that you can develop the mind, with time your ability to rest in the present moment, to have some control over the mind so the mind isn't completely flighty and wild, increases. And then all these wonderful things begin to happen as you begin to be able to rest in the present moment and the mind doesn't leave it. The wonderful things happen. It's kind of like the mind is a room, and that room is filled with things that are all wound up. Maybe it's filled with springs. And if the room is all tight, the walls are really closing in on all those springs, the springs can't move, they can't unwind. If we open up the room, open up the walls, and make lots of room for all those springs, then the springs naturally begin unwinding until they're all unwound. In the same way, when the mind which is completely preoccupied with desires, with aversions, with fears, with fantasies, with planning, with busyness, with memories, with regrets, it's like the mind has gotten really claustrophobic. And all the unresolved, all the wound up ways that we are have nowhere to move. In fact, what's likely to happen is you'll keep adding springs into that room, stuffing springs into that room. And when you start to be in the present moment is actually very spacious. There's a lot of room in the present. There's very little room in the past, and you can't make any more room in the past because it's done. And there's very little room in the future because it doesn't exist. where we find a lot of room for the mind is in the present moment. And so when you can stabilize your mind in the present moment so it rests there and stays there, then one of the benefits is all this deeper stuff, all these springs begin to unwind. As the springs begin to unwind, then we certainly begin to understand ourselves better, have greater insight in what makes us tick and what makes us run, what motivates us. But also, as we unwind, we begin appreciating some of the beauty of who we are in the present, or what reality is in the present. We start having a more intimate and direct contact with our life. And that is certainly one of the goals of Buddhist practice, is to have certain intimacy with the life as it's lived, as opposed to as it's thought about or fantasized about or how we project onto it. So these 5 weeks are dedicated to laying out some of the ideas of the mindfulness practice and to kind of lay out the full scope of it systematically or sequentially over these 5 weeks. So the weeks will build on each other. And the first week, we focus mostly on meditation posture and very simple meditation on the breath. And then next week, we'll talk about how to include the body as part of a contemplative practice, how to deal with pain, physical pain, how to deal with having a human body, how to be embodied as we go about our life. The next week, we'll talk about the emotions and how to include emotions within the scope of mindfulness. The fourth week will be our cognitive world of thoughts, and the fifth week will be a little bit about bringing it all together and integrating it into our wider life. So it's done over 5 weeks. On each week I'll have a handout for you all. There's probably enough handouts back there for today by the back door. If you don't have it, you can pick it up as you leave. And the handout will kind of review some of the instructions for that particular week. And also there'll be a set of exercises there that you can do at home. So more than just simply doing the mindfulness practice meditation, you might want to use some of these exercises in various contexts of your daily life to be able to get a sense of how useful this practice is in our daily life. It's not just simply a meditation practice I'm teaching you, but rather it's a way of living a life which is more attentive and more present. So the last thing I'll say as an introduction is that in the Buddhist tradition that I teach in, there's a very strong dedication in offering the teachings freely and to offer it without any cost. And therefore, we offer this that way. And you can come and receive these teachings whatever way you want, and certainly freely if you'd like. And there are these two baskets in the doorway, which usual English way of understanding it is that they're donation baskets. Though the word donation doesn't quite capture the spirit of how we function. But for now, we call it donation baskets. And what we like, there's two baskets, one for the rent and one for me. So we rent these facilities from the Quakers, and it's helpful if everyone who comes and uses our facilities here, our classes, helps pay for that rent. And if everybody did a dollar or two for rent, that would cover our rent and our other kind of expenses we have for putting these things on. And then the teacher basket is for you to do with as you wish. Suggested donation is $10 per class, but it can be a lot more than that, and it can be a lot less than that. It can be nothing. No one's watching you, or no one. It's really, really your inspiration as you would like to make this whole thing work. So it's very unusual here in the West that I'm a full-time Buddhist teacher, and in that I'm doing it in the Buddhist tradition. All my livelihood comes from the donations I receive. So that's a very unusual way of living. And people don't quite understand that. But so be it. So, one of the important foundations for meditation practice is to have a good posture, meditation posture. And so I'm going to review a little bit some of the basic points of the posture. You can sit either in a chair or you can sit on the floor. The advantage of sitting on the floor is that you're more stable because if you sit kind of somewhat cross-legged, then you have this tripod effect of your knees and your butt, which kind of creates a nice strong base. Also, your center of gravity is lower this way. And when your center of gravity is lower, it's actually easier to relax your torso. It's actually quite nice to have your center of gravity really low. It kind of helps the mind kind of settle also. But those are just kind of pragmatic benefits. Many people meditate in a chair quite successfully, and if you'd like to do that, you're more than welcome. Now, if you're sitting on the floor, the recommendation is that you sit on a big cushion. You find a round cushion or a pillow or something. And some people sit on these round cushions like this. And some people sit on crescent moon pillows like this. And other kinds of pillows people sit on. And the idea of sitting up higher is that it kind of tilts the pelvis forward a little bit. And then it's easier to keep your back straight. Because one of the most important principles of meditation posture is keeping your back upright and straight. If you sit flat on the floor, there's a very strong tendency. It's almost impossible not to slump. But if you sit up higher, it's a lot easier to keep yourself straight. Sitting cross-legged, I recommend that people sit not actually cross-legged, but one foot in front of the other. You can see my arms. One leg is in front of the other. Both legs are on the floor. Both feet are on the floor. And that puts the least amount of torque on your knees. And most people find it easiest to sit that way. And also it creates a nice stable base. You're not lopsided. If you're sitting in half lotus, which is another classic way of sitting, it tends to tilt you a little bit to one side, unless you straighten out, which stretches one side more than the other. But there are various ways of sitting. You can cross your leg a little bit. You can have one foot up on your calf, which some people like to have. Another way of sitting on the floor is to sit on your knees. And you can sit like Bud is sitting there, which is on a bench. He has one kind of bench. You can also take one of these round cushions and put it upright and put it between your ankles and then sit down on it. So that way you are on your knees. And some people find it a lot easier to do that way. And it's fairly stable to sit this way also. That reminds me. We started a new system this time. The class goes until 8:30. And then what we're going to do is after the class is over each day, from 8:30 to 9, we're going to have a senior student who's been part of our community for a long time be available in the library. If those of you who are here would like to ask more questions and find out more kind of from all kinds of things from a person who's been around for a while and practiced for a while, in case, for whatever reason, it might be nice for you to have that kind of availability. So Bud will do that today. And so in the library at 8:30, if you want to talk with a senior student and ask further questions and talk about how it's going or whatever's on your mind. So sitting, and then you want to have a straight spine, upright spine. It can help if you take your hands on either side of your hips, and you can do this on a chair too, but on the ground, and lift yourself almost off your cushion or your chair, so your chest comes up. And then as you release your hands, you let your shoulders roll back. And then you'll probably find yourself much more alert, upright, than you were before. If you're sitting on the chair, it's helpful, it's important that your knees not be higher than your hips, because then it tends to make it difficult for the back. And they should either be the knees should be the same level as the hips, or maybe preferably slightly lower than the hips. The usual suggestion is to have your feet parallel to each other, straight out, not crossed. Though some people have their legs out wide like this, they feel that's more stable. And both feet firmly on the ground, flat on the ground. If you're sitting in the chair, the recommendation is that you do not use the backrest. Some people have to use a backrest because of injuries or back problems or whatever, in which case it's completely fine to use the backrest. But if you can avoid using the backrest in the chair, you're better off in the long term. And the reason for that is that, one of the reasons for that is that there's actually a very strong relationship between our posture and our inner life, our inner attitudes, our approaches to life. And after all, we use the word posturing. When someone's posturing, it's not just simply that they're taking some interesting posture. It's an attitude that they're kind of expressing to you. There's a strong relationship to our physical posture, how we hold it, and our inner life. And in that, we want to develop some inner self-reliance through this practice. It's helpful if the body is self-reliant, if the back is self-reliant. So if you can avoid using the backrest, that's a good thing. So, and then your hands, you can do anything with the hands where they're both kind of doing the same thing, or symmetrical. I often will have my hands on my thighs or close to my knees. The classic Buddhist thing to do is to have your hands actually together, holding each other, one in front of the other. You want to be careful that your hands don't pull your shoulders forward, because it can put a strain in your shoulders. If you have your hands too far forward, you want to maybe pull it back. So your elbows are kind of right next to your sides of your body. If you have your hands in front of you, that also can pull the shoulders. And if you find your shoulders getting sore, you might get a pillow or something and put it on top of your ankle so your hands can be higher, like this, you can see. It's best to try to balance your head on your neck. Now, most people think their heads are balanced just fine, thank you, on their heads as it is. But in fact, sometimes people, their heads are projected forward, or they lean forward, or they're tilt up. And you want to kind of spend a little bit of time kind of finding a nice balance for your head. And it helps if you kind of can feel or create a little bit of space between the last vertebrae and the skull as you sit down. So it tends to bring the chin back and down a little bit if you do that. Kind of open that up a little bit. So you really have an alert kind of vertebrae of your spine all the way up through your neck. And then in our tradition, we sit with the eyes closed. You don't have to do that, but that's what we recommend. And it means gently closing the eyes. The mouth is kept closed, and we breathe through the nose, unless there's some reason to breathe otherwise. So that's the basics on the posture. So maybe I should stop at this point and ask you if you have any questions about that or anything else I've said so far. Is that clear enough? Yes. No one? It's all clear? Yes.
You talked about how to straighten the spine.
Yeah.
I can imagine wanting to do that, not just at the very beginning of sitting, but during whatever. How do you keep the spine straight?
Well, generally, you don't want to move a lot. Some people will fidget a lot or move about a lot as they're sitting, sometimes constantly adjusting, looking for the perfect posture. There is no perfect posture, so at some point you have to just kind of accept how you are. If two or three times in the course of half an hour sitting you make an adjustment, that's okay. But you don't want to do much more than that. If you start slumping, then at some point just stay with a slump and meditate with that. Otherwise your mind will stay agitated. However, with time, an inner strength will develop where you'll be able to have the ability to stay upright by yourself and not slump. Okay, so let us try some meditation. So take as comfortable and stable meditation posture as you can. And then gently close your eyes. And then at the beginning of a period of meditation, it's helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. As you breathe in deep, imagine that you're filling your body from the inside, connecting to your body from the inside, becoming aware of your body. And then as you exhale, you're relaxing. You're settling into your body, relaxing into your seat. That long, slow, deep in-breath helps establish that connection to the present moment in your body. Reminds you where you're going to be. And then letting your breath return to normal. No particular way that you need to breathe. And then it's also helpful for in the beginning of this meditation session that you spend a few minutes at the beginning scanning through your body to see if there's any obvious muscles which are tense that might be easy to relax or soften. You might do it systematically, beginning up at your forehead, softening the forehead, the eyebrow area. Softening a little bit your eyes. Some people find it helpful to imagine your eyes are looking down and in. If your eyelids are fluttering about, don't worry about it. Don't be bothered by it. It's okay. It might be possible to relax your jaws. And then also if you can relax your shoulders. And then particularly useful for meditation is to soften your belly, to let your belly be relaxed. Many people have a lifetime of training of holding in their stomach. It's helpful to, if you can overcome that lifetime of training and soften your belly, let it hang forward. Makes it easier to breathe. And then taking a few moments to feel the whole body, as much of your body as you can be aware of. Many people brace themselves against life. If it's possible, maybe as you exhale, to relax your body. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of your breathing. Now in this practice, we make no special effort to breathe in any particular way. but rather just let the breath breathe itself, whatever way it is, casually, lightly. And what we want to become aware of is not the breath, not the air, but rather the body's own experience of breathing. The sensations of expansion and contraction, the movement of the belly or the chest, the sensations on the inside of the nostrils or the tip of the nose. If you have trouble feeling your breathing, you can put a hand on your belly or your chest, and you might feel the movement there. One of the things we're trying to do in meditation is to have the mind and the body be in the same place at the same time. If you're sitting here and your mind wanders off into what happened earlier today or what's going to happen tomorrow, then your mind is someplace else. And your body is here. But if your attention can be centered on your breathing as it's happening right now, then your mind and the body are in the same place. There's a rhythm to your breathing. There's the in-breath is followed by out-breath, it's followed by in-breath. There's an alternation of expansion and contraction. Inevitably, the mind will wander off in its thoughts. When you've noticed that has happened, you can be, in some sense, very accepting of it. No need to judge yourself or be critical of that. Just as soon as you've noticed it, however, without much fanfare or judgment, or begin again with your breathing. Let go of whatever you're thinking about and come back to the very simple, basic sensations of breathing. And a way to help you stay with the breath is to label each in-breath and each out-breath. You can label it as in and out, or some people prefer rising for the rising of the abdomen or the chest, and falling for when it falls. And the idea here is to use a very basic and very simple thought to help you stay present, rather than having your thinking mind idle so you can wander off wherever it wishes. It's a very subtle, quiet little thought in your mind. In, out. Helping you just to rest with your breath.